nice to be here. And what I want to, so I also talk about Hastings counterexample. And this is a work, like joint work with Michał Paradeski. And it's actually the output of when we try to understand Hastings proof, and then we put in a language that was easier to us, then I guess maybe it's easier to some of you as well. So just to set up the notation, so a quantum channel is just a CP trace preserving map, and I will call the input space the space of the sender S, and this will be just a finite dimension space, and the dimension of this space I'll just call like the size of S, like that, so it's CS. And the same thing for the receiver, which is the output of the channel, I'll call it R throughout the talk. And then we have time spring form of the channel, which is for every channel we can just find some isometry U, which will map from the input space S of the sender to the output space R and to environment that I call E. And then it's just you put the state here, the isometry is applied, and we trace out the E register. And this implements the channel. So sometimes I also denote this dimension by DS, but mostly it would be just S. Okay. So what was the additivity conjecture? Yeah. And actually, I don't know when it was formulated and was the first time people talk about it. Maybe someone here knows it, but I think it was early 90s, I guess. So it had a long time for quantum information standard, right? And the easiest formulation, it just says that if you take two quantum channels, lambda one, lambda two, and then you look at the minimum output entropy, which is just you have a channel, and then you apply a state and look at the von Neumann entropy of the output state, and you minimize overall input states. And then this conjecture said that this function was additive on tensor product of channels, right? And well, the reason why so many people were interested in this conjecture was that if it were true, we would have nice formulas for many quantities that we are interested in quantum information. So the most important is classical capacity, as Chris explained. But we also have for some other quantities like entanglement cost and distillable common randomness, distillable local purity, and maybe even some others. And well, it's missing reference, but this equivalence of additivity of all these quantities was shown by Shaw, and some of them also by Koash and Pinto. But well, then Hastings came along and he proved that it's wrong. The conjecture is false. And moreover, if you want to have a counterexample, we just have to take a channel at random. So we choose the isometry of the channel from the half measure. And then if you choose the right input, output, and environment dimension, then we get a counterexample with high probability. And well, I think you cannot see anything here, right? Ah, okay, yes, well, sorry. So, yeah, there was some reference, a Hastings reference, and then Foucault and King, and Algun, Jarek, and Werner, and Collins and Ishita. Then we are going to hear about these other proof strategies as well during today. We already heard the first, and we are going to hear the others. And, yes. And, well, what I want to say about the proof that I'm going to show you is that perhaps it's the closest from the standard approach in quantum information to prove things, right? So we will try to get it as close as possible from like Hayden and Winter proof for the p norms. Okay, so for the proof strategy, and we really only focus on one of these points, but just remember from the last talk. To show a counterexample, we first take a channel lambda, and then we consider like the conjugate of the channel, which is just we take the isometry and apply and take the conjugate of this isometry, and then we get a bound on the minimum output entropy of the tensor product, and that doesn't really depend on anything of the channel, only on the dimensions of the input, output, and environment. And then on the other hand, we take now a random choice for lambda, and we show that with high probability the output will be big. The output entropy will be big. And in particular, you show, when you compare these two, that this quantity here will be smaller than twice this one here. And then we get a conflict there. Okay? So the lower bound, which is, which is basically based on the work of Hayden and Winter, is just that we consider two channels, the channel itself and the conjugate, and now we would like to prove that it doesn't have too much big output entropy. And the way to do that is just to show that if you choose a particular input state, the output state will have a large at least one large eigenvector, okay? And the choice for the input state is just the maximum entangled state of S and S prime here. And then if you do a calculation, you can show that the maximum eigenvalue of this operator is bigger than the dimension of the input space, the dimension of the output with the receiver, and the environment dimension, okay? So in particular, this is only interesting when R is bigger than S. And then in this case, you find that you have a non-trivial bound on the maximum eigenvalue, right? So if you don't know any information, we could only say that it's bigger than 1 over E. But now, 1 over E squared. And then the strategy would be to take these two to be comparable. And then we'll see that instead of being just 1 over E squared, it's just 1 over E. So it's a bit bigger. And then if you do a calculation, you just you can show that from this bound, you get a upper bound on the minimum output entropy, which is S is here. And we get this formula for it, okay? So, so what we want to do is to get a lower bound on the output entropy channel of one user of the channel and show that twice it is smaller than this one. Right. Sorry, it's bigger than this one. And this is really the content of the talk, okay? Right, so I think that simplifies the problem, at least when if you want to think about it, it makes things easier is to eliminate the channels in the problem and then just talk about subspace. And there is a way to do that people have considered before, and it's just that you have a channel with this time spring form, and then we can just associate a subspace in a bipartite space, R and S, and that subspace is the following. It's just we take any state in the input state, which is just S, and we apply the isometry, which maps S to R S product. I'm sorry, this should be E. So this is E, right? So the isometry maps S to R S product E. And then if we have, suppose now that the state is pure and we apply this isometry, and now we have a bipartite state, right? So we have a pure quantum state of two parties. And what's very easy to show is that if you want to calculate the minimum output entropy of the channel lambda, this is just equal to the minimum entanglement of I state in the subspace. And here's some notation that maybe it's not better to clarify. So when I call psi r, I just mean you take the trace or partial trace over E. Right? So website what in this space are E. Okay? So the problem in the end is just you want to find what's the minimum purity of reduced states on this bipartite subspace. And this is just like a measure of the entanglement of R and E of this state, right? So in the end, the problem is about finding subspaces in a bipartite state that are highly entangled. All states have a high amount of entanglement. Okay? And the proof of this is really simple. The only observation that you have to do is that because this function is concave, the minimum here can be taken, like you can take the minimum here over pure states. And once you do that, well, then you have the form. Okay, so once we are in this formulation, then we can try to find these subspaces which are highly entangled. And there was a construction already of those subspaces. But let's see first which property we would require to get a counterexample, right? So what we would like is that we have a subspace S of this bipartite state of dimension s, for which for all states we have this relation, right? Because if you multiply this by 2, then we get something bigger than the bound that we had for the minimal output entropy of 2 channels. So we would like to find a subspace which satisfies this relation, okay? And what we are going to see is that if you take this subspace from the Haar measure, then it will satisfy it with high probability, even something better than that. And well, what I mean by taking a subspace from the Haar measure is just that you first fix some projector, for example, you sum over the S first computational basis state, and then you just apply a Haar unitary to this projector, and that's it. And this is the projector associated with the subspace. Okay? Right. And then I'll show that, so like Hastings proof shows that if you take this U from the Haar measure with this choice of dimension, so the input dimension space is equal to the environment dimension space, and both are much bigger than the output dimension space. And this could be even one is linear to the other, but I'll take them to be the same for simplicity. Then we find a counterfactual here. Okay? Right. And so I think the main tool that we are going to use to get this a construction for these subspaces is what's called concentration of measure on the sphere. And here is a possible statement for this phenomenon. And it's just that suppose we have a set on a sphere, on a high dimension sphere of dimension n. So this is Sn minus 1. And then we have a set which has measure greater than half. Okay, so it occupies more than half of the whole sphere. Then if you define a new set M epsilon, which is just the epsilon neighborhood of this set, so all the points in the sphere which are epsilon close to points in M, if we can use the Euclidean distance, for example, then then the complement of the set will be extremely small. So meaning that the fraction of points in the sphere which are in the complement of M epsilon will be something exponentially small in the dimension of the sphere. So in terms of probability, it means that if you take a random choice of x of a point in the sphere, then the probability that x doesn't belong to the set M epsilon is something exponentially small in N in the square of epsilon, and C is just some constant. Okay? And a easy corollary of this, which is very useful, and it's called Lev's lemma, is the following. So now we take any function from the sphere to the real, for example, and we require that this function is at the Lipschitz. So just meaning that, right? So we take 2 points, and then the difference of the values from these 2 points is smaller than eta, which is a constant, times the distance of the 2 points. And then we find that if you take the average value of this function, the probability over a random point in the sphere that the value on the function deviates by more than epsilon from this average value is something exponentially small. And exponentially small, again, in the dimension, in the square of the distance of the deviation, and also in the inverse square of the Lipschitz constant. Okay? And, well, this is a result which is very useful in quantum information, and the reason is that we can identify the set of pure states, pure quantum states, just 2 points on a sphere, right? So if we have a pure state on a complex space of 3 dimensions, this is just if, and this of course is normalized, so the 2 norm is 1, then this is just equal to a point on a sphere of dimension 2d minus 1, right? So we can directly apply this this Lev's lemma to questions about quantum states, and then what we get roughly is that if you have a well-behaved function on quantum states in high dimension, it will be extremely concentrated around its average value. Okay, so now one possible strategy to solve the problem is just to directly apply Lev's lemma to the entropy function and see what we get. And this was done by Hayden, Log, and Winter. And then, well, first the average, if you take a random state on the bipartite Hilbert space of dimension R and E, and we calculate the average, it will be very close from the maximum value of log R. So this will be the average. It deviates at most by a ratio of R and E. Okay? And then if you just apply Lev's lemma now, and we can compute the Lipschitz constant of the entropy function, and it's just log R, then what we get is that. So with probability, the probability that the entropy is smaller than this quantity is really small. Exponentially smaller than the dimensions. And now we can combine this large deviation bound with another easy trick, which is called epsilon net, and get a large subspace which are highly entangled, right? So let me just remind you what epsilon net is. So you have a set A, and then suppose we have a set of points n such that for every point in x, sorry, for every point x in A, we can find another one in the set n for which they are close, and they are far away at most by epsilon. Then we say that the set of point n is an epsilon net for A. Okay, and there is a easy construction for a set of pure quantum states of an epsilon net in Euclidean distance, and we have a bound on how many points we need, and this is just like something exponentially in the dimension, and that's 5 over epsilon to the power of 2d. Okay, so now we can just combine the large deviation bound from before, from Hayden, Log, and Winter, with this epsilon net, and try to get something for the worst case in the subspace, right? And the idea is very simple. So we know that with high probability, if you take a random state in the subspace, this bound is true. And then we say, okay, so now we look at the probability that is true for every point in the epsilon net. Then if you just use the union bound, this would be the probability. But because the epsilon net is every point in the subspace is close to a point in this epsilon net, if you take a delta net with this delta, we'll get that, we'll get that all the points in the subspace we have entanglement more than that minus epsilon, okay? And then we can do that and just check what the numbers we get. And then what we find is that with high probability, if you take a random subspace of this dimension, then we have states that contain this amount of entanglement. So they are highly entangled, okay? And then we can see that if this is enough, and it's not, okay? It's actually very far away from what we would need. So for the counter example, we need the subspace of dimension given by that, which is epsilon away from the maximum value or for the average value for entanglement. And what we get is that. So both the dependence on epsilon is wrong, and we have this factor of log r, which is bigger, okay? So basically, this approach doesn't work for the Von Neumann entropy directly. But I just want to note that it does work for many entropies, and this is basically the argument from Hayden and Winter for the counter examples, which should be here. Okay. So just a remark, I want to say that this technique, or you have a large deviation bound, and then use epsilon net to get that something's true for all the points in some sets, is very useful in quantum information, and there are many applications. Here's some of them. And I guess often from all these papers are here, so you can just ask them if you want to know about this these results. But this slide is just to convey the idea that it's this simple idea, large deviation bound plus epsilon net, is very powerful in quantum information. And the point of Hastings' proof that I want to make here is that it gives at least two, maybe even three ideas on how to improve these arguments, and this might be useful somewhere else. Okay, so what are the ideas? Well, how are we going to do it in reminder of the talk? First, it will be useful not to apply these arguments of a large concentration bound and epsilon nets to the Von Neumann entropy directly, but rather to the two norm, and then we use the two norm to bound the Von Neumann entropy. Okay, then we find a way to improve the large deviation bound, still using Lev's lemma, but with a twist to it. And then finally, even with these two, it's almost enough to get a contra example, but not quite. And then I'll show you, or at least comment on two ways to improve on this epsilon net estimate. One done by Hastings originally, and another one which I learned in this paper from Obrun, Jarek, and Werner, but which apparently is actually an old twin in geometric asymptotic analysis, and it's good to know. I will show you what's this trick. Okay, so the first part, which is very simple, is just instead of bounding the minimum entropy of the subspace, we want to bound the maximum distance to maximum leak states in two norms. Okay, and then we just use this very simple relation. We just say that this minimum entropy is always bigger than the maximum possible one, log r, minus some deviation, which is just the dimension times this maximum distance. Okay, and the proof is very simple. We just use that the entropy is bigger than the two entropy, and then we apply some this relation for the log, and we get it if you rearrange. So don't worry, but this is true and is the relation we're going to use. Okay, that's the first thing. So now what will be the point is that for this new quantity, we can find subspaces for which the following is true. So we take the maximum of this distance over any state in the subspace and take the square of the two norm, and we find that it's smaller than 1 over c is a constant and 1 over the dimension of the space to the square. Okay? And then if you just use this bound, we get that the minimum entanglement in the subspace deviates from the maximum value just by a factor of 1 over the dimension of the subspace. And this is enough for the counterexample. Because remember, we just needed this to be true. So choosing this S and E to be equal, we are actually a factor of log R away from what we needed. Okay. So now we can just say, okay, now we want to work in this two norm, and we apply Lev's lemma again. So it's just another calculation. Lipschitz constant is a constant here, is 2. And we do the work. And then we find that this large deviation bound for the two norm, we apply epsilon nets again in the same way. And then we can only find a result much weaker than what we needed, right? Which is just that for most subspaces, the maximum distance is smaller than square root log r over r. And we needed 1 over r squared. So we have to improve it. But the observation is that this constant bound that we use for the Lipschitz constant, although it's the best we can have for the full space, is very far away from what we have for typical states, so for the majority of states in the subspace. And then we can use that to improve the bound. So just again, if you want to look at the full space, then a constant Lipschitz constant is the right thing. So an example, you take maximum entangled state, and then if you trace out, we just get maximum mixed state, so the distance is 0. And we take like this 0, 0 state, then the distance is almost 2, and therefore the Lipschitz constant is almost 2. But now, on the other hand, suppose we take two states, bipartite states psi and phi, such that the operator norm of the reduced states, so the maximum eigenvalue, is smaller than this. So A is at some constant over the dimension. Then what we can show is just some, is a simple thing, but I want to show you here now, is that using this bound on the maximum eigenvalue, we can get a much better Lipschitz constant. So we go from a constant to something 1 over square root of p. Okay? And moreover, this property that the maximum eigenvalue is small, it happens for the vast majority of the subspace. With this probability, it's true. So we can use that to get a better large deviation bound. And this is what we do here. So the first thing is that if you look at how Lev's lemma is proved, which is just a corollary of this measure of concentration inequality, we can prove also something analogous, which is like Lev's lemma, but when we have this intersection of two events, one is here should be the distance is bigger than epsilon, so there is a bigger or equal to epsilon missing here. So we look at the probability that the distance is bigger or equal to epsilon, and that the maximum eigenvalue is small, okay? And then we can get something exactly like Lev's lemma, but the only difference is that instead of a constant Lipschitz constant, we get this improved one of 1 over square root of p. And because it depends on the inverse of the square, we get a factor of r extra, okay? So it's the probability that this is bigger than epsilon, but at the same time, this is smaller than I forgot to put it bigger than epsilon there. And what we have also from Lev's lemma, and I won't show you, but proof, is that if you take psi at random, then the maximum eigenvalue of psi r, the probability that it's bigger than some constant over the dimension, is something exponentially small in the dimension of the space that is traced out, which is something that would be very big here. Okay? And I can just combine the two very simply. So so we just use this basic fact, right? You have a probability of the intersection of two events. This is always bigger than the probability of the first event minus the probability of the complement. And we apply it here. So this would be the probability of the intersection. And that's always bigger than the probability of the first event minus the probability of the complement of the second, right? And we have bounds for both these probabilities. So this is just from the pre. So this is the bound for that one. And this is the probability that the maximum eigenvalue is big. Okay? So what we see is that if you choose this epsilon to be some constant over the dimension, these two will be comparable. And then we can get this large deviation bound, which is the final result. So in the end, we just have a large deviation bound for the distance of this reduced state to the maximum mixed state in two norm. And it tells you that the probability that it's bigger than constant over the dimension of the space is something exponentially small in the dimension of the space, which is traced out the other space. What?
Yeah, just identity over the dimension, right?
Okay.
Sorry, here should be R. Okay, so now once we have this improved large deviation bound, we can try the same trick again, one more time, use epsilon less, and see what we get. And we almost get what we want, but not quite. So the same thing again, right? We choose epsilon net where epsilon is of order 1 over r squared. And then this maximum we can just is like this large deviation bound times the size of the epsilon net. And the size would be something like a constant times the size of the subspace and log r. Where this log r comes from the choice of the epsilon from the epsilon net, which is 1 over r squared, roughly. And then, okay, very nice. And then we'll see we choose such that this is smaller than 1, and we'll see what's the value we can get. And we get this. So we get a high probability around the subspace, the minimum attainment is deviates from the maximum value by this factor, and this is a constant, which can be very bad. And remember that we need it without the constant. So we are a constant away from what we want. Okay? And well, then this is the final part, how we improve these epsilon estimates. And there are two ways to do that. One way is really to eliminate this epsilon net pass and to use another argument, which is probabilistic one. And this is the original idea of Hastings, which we saw in the last talk, and maybe I will briefly mention it. But there is an idea which I just learned recently from this paper of Ovron, Sharek, and Bell, and which is very nice, and which is a way to use epsilon net in a smarter way, and then just to get rid of this log r factor. Okay? And, well, they say that this was attributed to, they attributed this to Shechtman, and Shechtman attributed this to Kolmogorov, and I think Kolmogorov proved it, but I'm not sure. I'm not going to talk much about this because I think Jarek is going to talk about it in his talk. Yes? But it's, I think, something very nice to know for us and for who works on quantum information, and it's just that whenever you have like this large deviation bound for a function that doesn't depend on phases, so in quantum information language, you have a function on clear states, and this function is equal to, that one, so where this is a phase, so it's independent of the phase of the state. Then we can basically apply the same idea, like large concentration bound, and then epsilon net to get something about the full space, but without this log epsilon factor, the epsilon net. So it's a way to eliminate this log epsilon. Okay, and I don't want to get into detail, but we are going to hear the next one. And then there is this epsilon net part by basics, which I'm going to mention here. So the way he did that was not to use EpsilonS, but now to we had a lower bound on this probability, and what Hastings did is to get we had an upper bound from before from measure concentration, and what Hastings did was to get a lower bound. And the lower bound he got is the following. So this is the same quantity from before, and then proving this is bigger than some explanation is more in the dimension of the subspace. Is prime is a constant, times the probability that the maximum state in the subspace that this distance from the maximum mid state is bigger than C prime, A is another constant, well, it's the same one, and C prime is another universal constant over R squared. Okay? But now we can compare with our previous bound, which gives us upper bound, and if we just compare the two, we see we get the result we want. Right, that that the probability of a random choice of the subspace that this distance is bigger than a constant over R squared, it goes to zero when the dimension goes to infinity. Okay, and that shows well, and that gives us a contract then. So I have 9 minutes, I guess. So what I wanna maybe what I want to do is just to show you how very quickly how he gets these bounds, okay? Which we already saw before, so it's going to be easier, I guess. And I think it's a nice idea. So first, just for notation, we have a subspace, right? We have a subspace on R, on R E. And now the maximum over states, that just turns to notation, okay, of psi R minus that peak state. Let's call the maximizing state just psi, okay? So this psi simple R just is the state that maximizes this function. And now the point is that if you take a state, we take a general state in the subspace, then we can write in the following form. So we can write it as a superposition. So here we can just do of this state, which is the furthest away from my density in the subspace, and some rest. Okay? And now the point is that if you take this state uniformly at random in the subspace, then lambda and the rest state phi, they will be independently distributed. And moreover, this will be just, again, a random state in the subspace of S perpendicular to orthogonal to psi R tilde. To psi tilde. Okay? And then we can get it. So what we want is this property. Well, we want a lower bounds probability, and this originates the probability over all states in the bipartite Hilbert space. But now we can just write this as two probabilities. So one probability over a random subspace S, and the probability over I state psi in this random subspace. Right? It's the same thing. Okay. And and now just using this form, we can see that this probability would be bigger than the following. So thank you.
minus, well, the same thing, but the emission point rate of this. Okay, and well, we just use the form of that and expanded it and use triangle inequality here. So this quantity using this form is always smaller, well, it's always bigger than that one, and the point probably is bigger. Another point, so maybe I just mentioned what's the rest of the argument, is just because with lambda and phi, they are independent, then this probability reduction gets the product of two probabilities. One is always bigger than the probability that lambda is bigger than half. Okay, this will be one part. Times the probability that, well, that all these things are, this probability is bigger than a over half. Now, all these things, they are small. So the first thing is that this probability, it will be roughly just exponential for a constant times times the dimension of this space, which is e. Right, because this is just a cap in this space. And for these other ones, this will be the one we are interested in, which is the minimum or the maximum distance. And these other ones will be extremely small. So that's the point. So we can show that if you choose E to be much bigger than R, then this will be extremely small. So, I mean, we have the bound, but we can just ignore it here for the moment. This other one will also be extremely small. We can ignore it here. And the probability that remains is a factor of half. It's just the minimum, the probability that we're interested, which is the probability that for subspace, the maximum, right, the maximum distance is bigger than a constant over R. Okay? And that's that. So that's it, I guess. Just, let me just restate some open questions from the previous talk. So first, of course, these counterexamples, they are probabilistic, right? So it would be very nice to find some explicit counterexamples. And also, the violations, they are extremely small. So in Fukuda and King's paper, they did some estimates, and unless I'm wrong, the best violation was 10 to the minus 6. Okay, so really small. And would be, if you look at rainy entropies, Hayden Winter counterexamples, they are extensive, right? So they are proportional to the number of qubits of the channel, of the output of the channel. So it would be nice to see, to find something similar for the phonon entropy, or to see maybe we cannot find some. Both ways would be interesting. And finally, this question, which is maybe from the perspective of quantum information theory, is the most exciting, which is to find a counterexample, the way we just did it, Hastings just did it, and we explained here, to the regularized quantity, right? So to, am I right, what is regularized? So the regularized minimum output entropy of the channel is just the limit when you have infinitely many uses of the channel, you divide by the number of channels. Okay? So this is the open question. If it's obvious. And if it's not, then this just translates into no additives of the classical capacity, which would be something very interesting. And that's it. So thank you for your attention.
Okay, there are no questions.
Perfect.
Do you have any ideas for candidates for violation?
Of the asymptotic? No.
Yeah.
Yes. No, I mean, I think there's, I don't think, I mean, at least I don't know any argument why these one constructions could give these violations. Right? So the reasons why they give here doesn't work there, right? Once they make many copies of this, the same subspace, we lose all this concentration of. And except, well, I mean, basically, we don't know what happens.
about the maximum and naming the subspaces. So, yeah, I don't know. That's the best.
For the von Neumann entropy violations, they're the 10 to the minus 6, so how large do you, would you like them?
I think like what they found for the Rain entropies would be nice, right? Something so they found that if you have the Rain entropies, the minimum, right, of lambda and its depths, that's roughly the same as for one channel. So it like it's really extensive, that violation here, right? Mm-hmm. That would be nice, but I don't know if it's true.
How do you calculate the classical capacity?
How you calculate?
Yeah.
I is using this foliable solid form, right? That, so the volume quantity of the channel, we take the minimum over some ensembles. This is a property distribution, these are quantum states. And we take
you want the maximum?
Yes.
Oh, okay, it's just that quantity.
Yes, just
all right.
Okay.
Do you think there's an, you know, you've seen this infinite probability, that there's an infinite dimensional model which, you know, just does violation, maybe not on a finite dimensional, but, you know, this large Bernoulli algebra thingy. Is that possible? Right one, you know?
Well, semi-possible, but...
yeah, it'd be nice if you have one, you know, one guy which, you know, where we can look at and
yeah.
That does violation, period. Mm-hmm.
Well, I have a comment on that. It's an interesting feature of these examples that the violation actually goes to zero as the dimension goes up. The probability grows, but somehow the degree of violation disappears. So maybe not the
so,
right.
So maybe that's not the right thing
to. Well, but in this construction, yeah.
Another one.
Yeah.
Last year, anyway, or 2 years ago, Hastings had a conjecture that all the violations are of this. Sort of form, you know, tensor lambda bar.
Yeah.
That if you have a bunch of channels and you pair them up that way, then it'll be additive.
Yes. Yes.
I don't know. I just wanted to see if you had thought about that.
I think it's just being optimistic. But
yeah.
I mean, you have a reason why it's not that you say, okay, that's the only reason. But who knows what? I don't think there is any indication at the moment that it could be true. So. Maybe it's just, I think it's just that we don't understand what these optimal states is, and probably if you use more use of the channel and choose some other states, it might go even lower. I would believe in that, but again, I don't know.
Any further questions? If not, let's thank Fernando again.